Now, our feature presentation.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Bay Area filmmakers are having a hella good year. Ryan Coogler directed Marvel's smash hit Black Panther this year, which took place partly in Oakland. Then Boots Riley released the surreal comedy Sorry to Bother You. Now two more Oaklanders, Daveed Diggs of Hamilton and Raphael Cassell, are out with a buddy comedy that explores gentrification, police brutality, and identity. Blind Spotting. As always, we'll be getting into the details of the film, spoilers and all. So, if you haven't seen it yet, and you want to see it before you hear this conversation, you can check out this and all our other Movie Club discussions later online at the1a.org. That's the word the number one, the letter A, .org. If you've seen Blind Spotting, or you're willing to deal with spoilers, you'll find a great conversation just after this break.
Support for NPR and the following message come from U.S. Army Medicine, one of the nation's innovative medical institutions that puts healthcare professionals at the forefront of medicine. U.S. Army Medicine is an elite team pioneering new medical discoveries to make a difference in the lives of Americans. Army Medicine is your chance to push medicine further. Learn more at goarmy.com/amed.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Joining us for this meeting of the 1A Movie Club, as always, is our honorary vice president, John Horn, the host of the daily arts and entertainment program, The Frame, on KPCC Public Radio in Los Angeles. Mr. Vice President, welcome back to the program.
Happy to be back.
Joining us from KQED Public Radio in the Bay Area is Sundia Dirks, an East Bay Enterprise reporter and co-creator of the podcast American Suburbs. Sundia, it is so good to hear your voice again. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Josh. It's great to be here.
Former co-workers, can't you tell? And joining us from UC Berkeley is Malik Adan, the growth editor at Shadow and Act and the managing editor at Really Dope. That's R-E-E-L-Y. Malik, welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be on the program.
Let's start with your reviews of the movie. How many stars out of five? No fractions, please. No fractions, please. How many stars out of five would you give Blind Spotting and why? John Horn, what'd you think?
I'm going to give it a four. I love this movie a lot. And one of the reasons that I liked it, there's a reference in the film as a character is studying psychology to Rubens' vase. You can Google it. It's essentially two faces looking at each other. You either see their faces or a vase that is in between them. And it's, as one character says, it's hella hard to see both at the same time. And I think this film does an extraordinary job of looking at gentrification, race, friendship, police, in a very interesting way where you can actually see both at the same time. I think it really opened my eyes, and I lived in Oakland for a couple years when I was in school at Cal. I think it captured the city. I think it captured a lot of issues that a lot of people may not fully understand, and I think it's lyrical. I mean, it's a movie that is largely in verse, and which is extraordinary.
Sundia Dirks, what's your review? How many stars out of five and why?
So, like, I also have a kind of double consciousness when it comes to this film, where part of me wants to give it four stars, but there's part of me that has a critique that could give it two. While it gets gentrification anxiety and transforms that and shows you that and makes you feel it better than almost any film I've ever seen, I also felt it was over the top. It hit everything so accurately. I felt like I was playing Oakland bingo. Like every issue that's facing Oakland was laid out on a card and I was just getting bingo left and right.
Malik Adan, what about you? How many stars out of five and why?
Yeah, I think I'm have to go with four here as well. I think on one hand, yes, it's definitely a four-star film. It kind of, as everyone said, it kind of hits the notes. I think if you're a local, if you've been here, if you've really lived here for a long time, it really is a five-star film. And, you know, as a former New Yorker, for me, it kind of has the same love for the city and for the town that something like Take Five has, right? Where they're kind of walking you through every part of what Oakland truly is. They clearly know what it is and how it moves. And there's such this attention to detail, but I think that I'm keeping away one star because there are a few things that also kind of hit me, and this could be a better film. But I give it those four because it really came and showed out.
Malika Don, follow up on what Sundia Dirks just brought up in terms of this idea of playing Oakland bingo and how much of the city that it hit. How well do you think that Blind Spotting portrayed Oakland without kind of being heavy-handed in a way?
I think there are two things for me. The first is kind of that montage in the beginning, right? It kind of sets the tone for the entire film. It's the jab to the uppercut. That's the second part of the intro of the film. So we have an understanding of all this archival footage of what Oakland used to be, right? And then what Oakland is and potentially what Oakland is becoming. And it really sets tone for this sort of cultural fatalism in the sense that Oakland is truly losing the heart of what it is and who it is and the people who are the originators, right, of a certain era that has really defined the culture that everyone seems to want to love about Oakland. And they give you a very short montage of just kind of catching you up to present day, right? Like, meanwhile in the ranch. And then I've talked to a lot of friends about this, especially a few friends from Deep East Oakland. That opening scene where we're at Quickway, right, which is kind of an mm-hmm. Oakland staple, or was at least, because it doesn't really exist in its fullest glory now, really shows how these two Oakland natives, right, we have Colin, we have Miles, really relate to a home that is changing underneath their feet in real time. And I think there are a few other points in the film where it really shows those moments that are like so keyed into how people from Oakland actually really see the city changing around them, that are, you know, as she said, like so hitting the nail on the head that it's almost atomic in how accurate it is.
Quite a few of you sent us your thoughts about how gentrification as depicted in Blind Spotting struck you. One of the members of our 1A text club wrote, "I thought the film was so smartly written and wonderfully performed, it manages to provide an emotional facet of gentrification." Another text club member wrote, "The movie had a huge emotional impact on me. It's so real and so excellent and so devastating. I hope lots of people see it. I've lived in the U Street area of Northwest DC for almost 31 years, and I'm so disheartened by the gentrification and resulting congestion and upscaling. Needless to say, I could not afford to buy my modest one-bed, one-bath condo today, and I'm grateful to have it." And for those of you who don't know D.C., U Street is one of the hoppin' hot spots in Northwest D.C. right now and has changed super-duper fast in the last few years. Another listener writes, "I've seen the movie. I have to disagree that it tackles gentrification, but it includes a very small reference to it. I wasn't amazed by the film, but kudos for their attempt at their first film." We are speaking to John Horn, the host of The Frame from KPCC Los Angeles, KQED's Sundia Dirks, East Bay Enterprise reporter and co-creator of the podcast American Suburb, and Malik Adan, growth editor at Shadow and ACT and managing editor of Really Dope. We'd love to hear from you, too. Call us, 855-236-1A1A, email 1A@WAMU.org. As we're getting calls in, Sundia Dirks, can you paint a little bit of a clearer picture for folks who haven't been to Oakland and seen what the gentrification has meant? Give us an example or two of ways that if you're an Oaklander and you look around, you can tell things aren't what they used to be.
Well, you know, the green juice, which becomes this great metaphor in this film, because at your corner store, you can buy this fancy, you know, kale juice. Yeah, I can get kombucha at every corner store now in Oakland, and it doesn't matter, except probably with the exception of the Deep East. But in West Oakland, you go into a corner store and there's kombucha. That's just unheard of. Very much the places like West Oakland and Deep East Oakland were food deserts. They were really kind of abandoned by infrastructure. And all of a sudden, you're seeing a complete sea change, the fancy coffee shops. You're really seeing two Oaklands that don't fit together. You know, I wanted to say something about that opening sequence, which was so really powerful. And, you know, it was a split screen and you had different kinds of Oaklands on each side. You had the two Oaklands on each side. And one of them, which was so recognizable, was, you know, after a Warriors win, right? Because we're seeing the Warriors do fantastic. And it showed two different parts of Oakland. It showed Oakland downtown, where you have a lot of the white tech newcomer transplants celebrating the Warriors, you know, whooping it up in the streets. And then it showed you Deep East Oakland. Now, the Warriors have played in Deep East Oakland, and this is their last year there. They're going to San Francisco. Francisco, but they've played there for years. And the Deep East has loved them through the hard times. They have suffered with the Warriors. And so you see, you know, the Deep East celebrating, but you see police there everywhere, a heavy police presence. So gentrification is also about how these communities are policed and contained differently. It's not just about, you know, new white people coming in. It's about the ways in which some groups and some bodies are accepted and others are pushed to the side and not accepted.
And just to kind of clarify, if I could, just a little bit of the geography here. You've got, you know, the city kind of hugs part of the northeast part of San Francisco Bay. As you make your way kind of southeast, as it were, from downtown Oakland, you end up at Oracle Arena, which is in East Oakland. You've got the Oakland Hills, which are further inland. Then you've got the flats you make your way down, which tends to be the lower income parts of town. Oracle Arena, deep East Oakland, near Oakland International Airport. That's kind of the area that we're referring to. And you see little pockets of gentrification throughout the city of Oakland, whether it's in the part of the city that we see, whether it's with the Warriors moving, playing from the Oakland Arena to a new arena on San Francisco Bay in the San Francisco part of the city. John, it sounds like there's a lot of parts of that that were on the minds of the film's co-creators, David Diggs and Rafael Casal. You sat down with them to interview them. Here's part of what they told you.
We're trying to serve two purposes, right? To really, for folks who are from Oakland and from the Bay Area, to create something that they can really rally behind and ride for, because that's really important to us. And we want people to feel like they have something they can cheer for and that feels like them, but also to show it off to everybody else. And I love my city, and I do want to present it to the world.
That's David Diggs, the co-writer, co-producer, and co-star of Blindspotting. John, how well did they feel they did in that purpose? Did they succeed?
I think they did. And Oakland is not only a city that has, you know, a lot going on in terms of gentrification, but it's also across the bay from San Francisco, where, you know, you can't even afford to live because there's so much money being spent on tech. People are making so much money that a lot of those people are now moving into the East Bay. So Oakland is one of these cities that has this diverse culture, and yet it is being kind of consumed in some ways by what's happening across the bay. And I think that is part of what the gentrification story is really after. I mean, these are guys, Rafael and David, who know the city well. They've lived there. They met doing slam poetry. They think that the city is a beautiful thing, in for better and worse, for the things that, you know, that we like to celebrate, and some things like police brutality that we don't.
We'll continue our conversation in just a moment with John Horn, Sundia Dirks, and Malik Adan. We'll take a deeper dive into what happened, and we'll get more into this idea of gentrification, how it's playing out in Oakland and elsewhere. I'm Joshua Johnson. I am hella glad to be with you for this meeting of the 1A Movie Club from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from ACT, a flexible CRM trusted by millions worldwide. Manage customer contacts, track sales opportunities, and create professional marketing campaigns, all from your laptop or mobile device. Call 888-643-6400. Mention promo code NPR for a free Amazon Dot with your purchase of ACT. Or visit act.com/NPR to sign up for a free 14-day trial. ACT, growth made easy.
I'm Ann Powers from NPR Music. Last summer, we launched Turning the Tables, a project that radically changed how we talk about the history of popular music, with a list of the 150 greatest albums by women. This week, we're launching Season 2, looking at the 200 greatest songs by 21st century women. Check out who made the list and who didn't at n.pr/turningthetables.
Back now to our conversation with John Horn, Sundia Dirks, and Malik Adan. I should point out that we did get to speak with Rafael Casal, who co-wrote and co-stars in Blindspotting with David Diggs. You'll find that conversation online at the1a.org. That's the word the number one, the letter a, .org. Sundia Dirks, from your reporting, I wonder if you could respond to some of the folks who have commented. You know, a lot of people in Oakland and in the Bay Area in general have been spitting mad about gentrification since this latest development wave around 2010 jumped off. One of our listeners wrote through the 1A text club, "I'm a gentrifier and I think it's great. Old, dirty, disgusting neighborhoods get revived." And another member of our text club wrote, "I don't live in the city, so gentrification is not something I've experienced. How does gentrification differ from flipping a house?" Sundia, what's wrong with gentrification?
So, you know, to add to the thing that businesses change and the quality of the neighborhood change, the people change. So gentrification is about displacement, right? Like, you're talking about displacing Oakland's Black community. Between 2000 and 2010, Oakland's Black population dropped 25%. That's only increased in the years since then. You're seeing a decline, a bleeding out of Oakland's Black population. And that's really, really serious when you're talking about a city that was for so long a Black city. So, yes, it's great to clean up a neighborhood, but who are you cleaning it up for? And if you're just cleaning it up for the new white residents, but you're sending people of color and poor people of color, you're fragmenting them and dispersing them and displacing them and sending them to spaces where the networks that they built over years in those communities, right, the networks of people, the sort of the informal capital of human connection has been then taken away from them. How is it good for poor people of color? It's not, right? So gentrification that could somehow just uplift a neighborhood, yes, on the surface, that's wonderful. But that's not what happens. What happens is a vast displacement and replacement. Right now, Oakland, the single largest ethnic group in Oakland is white. It's Caucasian. That is crazy to me, because this was such a diverse city. And if you look at all of these movies that are coming out, if you look at Sorry to Bother You, if you look at Blindspotting, if you look at Black Panther, those are all Black filmmakers. The talent that is in Oakland is in many ways talent that comes from its Black people and from its people of color. But they can no longer afford to live in Oakland. That's what Oakland is losing. It's losing its sort of intellectual, historical, diverse soul. And also creating a problem where what you get is a rich white city. And where are the people going who are being forced out?
And just by way of clarity, the census figures show that Oakland is about 38% white, about 25% Black, 16% Asian, and about 27% of Oaklanders also describe themselves as Hispanic or Latino. About 27% of Oaklanders are white non-Hispanic. We heard from some listeners in the Bay Area who have seen this change firsthand. Mark emailed, "I grew up in Richmond, California. If you drive north from Oakland through Berkeley, you get to Richmond. I grew up in Richmond, and my mother taught school in Emeryville, which is kind of in that Oakland-Berkeley corner. I can't wait to see this film, as I've watched Emeryville undergo complete transformation in the past 2 decades. And now my hometown of Richmond is seeing gentrification arrive. The house I grew up in a blue-collar section of the Richmond Flatlands, sold for $15,000 in 1958, and now lists for close to $1 million. Let's get back on the phones now. Glenn in Raleigh, North Carolina is on the line. Glenn, what's on your mind?
I'm a licensed general contractor here in Raleigh, and I buy houses that are, frankly, not fit for livestock to live in, much less human beings. And I fix them, and I put them back on the market. And I don't just fix them, but I upgrade them to a point where they're gorgeous. They actually make the neighborhood look better. And where people complain about the price rise, I completely disagree with them, because as a contractor, yes, I put a house on the market, but the truth is we're price takers. I don't get to dictate what my house will bring when I'm done with it and ready to sell it. I have to gauge where the market's at. I have to take an offer from someone who's willing to pay for it. And if the house will not appraise at the price I'm asking, I either have to lower my price or they have to come out of pocket with additional cash against their up and above their loan limit. So where people complain about gentrification, it doesn't hold a lot of water when the problem really is they didn't take care of their homes in the first place. The things fall down, the neighborhoods look horrible, and then somebody like me comes in, fixes it,
right,
and I'm the bad guy?
Well, Glenn,
I
hear you. Thank you for chiming in as a contractor and a developer. I don't know much about Raleigh. I do know about the Bay Area. I was, you know, primary anchor at KQED for about 6 years, so that area I know, and I know South Florida, which is where I'm from. I know that in a number of these communities, these were not areas that were purely neglected. They may have been areas where industry left, or where development left, or where there were policies like redlining that prevented people of color from getting loans, no matter how well they tried to maintain their home. So it wasn't just personal neglect. How does that resonate with what you saw in Raleigh?
Well, in Raleigh, we have a limited amount of space here. We have a net influx of 47 families per day right now. And there is a housing shortage here. So we're experiencing some of the things here in Raleigh that you're describing in the Bay Area. Like Apple right now has purchased a campus here in Research Triangle Park, which is going to add about 10,000 families to the area. This is a burden on the area, but they bring a lot of money. And yes, money tends to displace people. I understand that. But like I had said before, I don't dictate how much I get for a house. I'm a price taker. And yes, we are, as a developer or a general contractor looking to redo houses and sell them, obviously I'm looking for things that I can make a profit on. I'm running a business, just like a grocery store, just like a dry cleaner. Nobody in his right mind is going to write a business at a deficit and expect to stay in business.
Well, but Glenn, your business is a little bit different. Your business is a little bit different in a place like the Bay Area. I mean, if it's the dry cleaner, I mean, I can get a suit dry cleaned across the street for $3, but I'm not bidding with other people. Hold on, Glenn. I'm not fighting with other people who are saying, I'll give you $5 for it. I got to get my suit back today. No. I'll give you $10. I'll take it this hour. In the Bay Area, it's a very different kind of bidding war, and developers can kind of charge whatever they want because someone's pockets are deep enough to pay it.
Well, you have some of that here, too. In fact, many houses in this area under the $400,000 price point will sell over ask. And like I said, we're price takers. I don't really dictate the price anymore. I'm offering a product into a market that's in high demand. You have the same thing in the Bay Area. And I will tell you, a person who sells his home in the Bay Area wants the last penny. He's not going to say, you know, it's really not fair to the next guy that I charge him $1 million for my house. I'm only going to charge him $700,000. I don't know anybody that's that generous.
Glenn, I appreciate you calling in and sharing your thoughts. Thanks very much for talking to us. Malika Don, I'd love you to react to what we just heard from Glenn.
Yeah, I have so many thoughts. To keep it really, really funky, this is a very hard thing to talk about without kind of exploding a little bit. But as Sundia said, right, like gentrification is not only forcing people out. This is structural and systemic violence, right? And I think that the what's a really good break point that she brought up was, you know, we're talking about Richmond and Oakland specific. If you want to get into economic history, Oakland and Richmond, right, these are coastal cities. These are cities that brought in so many people from South, specifically Black people, to work on the docks, to work in the shipping industry, right? That a lot of that shipping industry is gone. Richmond still has the Chevron plant up there, right? You have these kind of like industrialist societies that no longer exist. And as you said as well, you have redlining, right? Like unincorporated Richmond was created because they wanted to incorporate another part of Richmond and actually keep Black people out of certain parts of the city. Same thing with Oakland in certain parts. And so this isn't just an issue of, you know, and I think it's a terrible neoliberal understanding of personal responsibility for systemic issues. And I think that's what's really going on is that, you know, a lot of people are being forced out of their homes simply because they were never provided the economic opportunity to keep the ball rolling. Mm-hmm. And so when you have this like intersection of race, gender, economics, and then kind of turnover, right? As you said, like a lot of these developers and things will come in and sell to the highest bidder. Now, I understand that he's trying to, our caller is trying to connect things between Raleigh and Bay Area. But as you said yourself, the Bay Area is highly different because San Francisco itself is an untenable economic environment. We have people who literally work at Google's, Facebook's, any place that's getting all this VC money that is, you know, they're getting paid $400,000, $250,000 a year and can barely afford to buy a house in Oakland, let alone in San Francisco. And of course, all that stuff is getting pushed out to Vallejo, Richmond, Hayward, further down south, even East Palo Alto, further up north, Hercules, Antioch. This kind of sprawl is affecting the entire Bay Area. And obviously with Oakland being the closest to San Francisco,
right,
it is kind of feeling the biggest pinch. And so I think there's a lot of flaws in the caller's argument, because I understand, yes, we can talk capitalist economics, right? Like, you always want to get the best price. But this is not only a matter of personal responsibility, it's also a matter of the systemic violence that is compounded, as you said, because of the history of this area, and specifically how not only Black people have been treated, mm-hmm. but also immigrants, right? Like, the Bay Area has a large population of Filipino folks, Vietnamese folks, Chinese folks. Like, we have an entire swath of people of color who have been kept out of certain economic opportunities. And I think that one thing that often white folks in this country fail to understand is that when those things get compounded upon generations and years,
right,
this
right,
isn't
right.
just the even starting line anymore. And I think what's really interesting is that that's a lot of what the film tries to hint at. But obviously, as Rafael said, in 95 minutes, you can't tell that entire story, but you can tell a slice of it.
Right. Malika, I hate to cut you short.
Yes.
I know we're low on time. I should note we did have a conversation about redlining on this program with Richard Rothstein, who's the author of a book called The Color of Law. You'll find that on our website, the1a.org. John, before we let everybody go, I did want to talk to you a little bit about just Oakland in the movies. It's kind of amazing. You had Ryan Coogler with Black Panther and Fruitvale Station. Now you've got Rafael Casals and Daveed Diggs with Blindspotting. You've got Sorry to Bother You that's coming out. What do you make of this moment for Oakland in the movies? Is this a fluke, or is this here to stay?
Well, it's here to stay if these movies continue to do really well. We know that at least two of them so far have done incredibly well. Sorry to Bother You is off to a great start. Blindspotting is, you know, new to theaters. And listen, Hollywood has no agenda in terms of what cities it wants to feature. I think Oakland is a perfect kind of lab in terms of studying so many things about race, about diversity, about policing, about economic inequality, that in some ways it represents the country in a microcosm. And I'm going to say one other thing. I want to correct somebody, I think, misidentified the director of Blindspotting is Carlos Lopez Estrada. He's Mexican-American, and the film was financed by an Asian-American woman. So we talk about white gentrification, rich white people certainly run Hollywood. This movie behind the camera was made by people who are out of the Hollywood mainstream. Mexican-American director, Asian-American producer.
Right.
And I think that is a very good thing, and I think it represents change in Hollywood.
John Horn, the host of The Frame from KPCC, Sundia Dirks, East Bay Enterprise reporter for KQED Public Radio, and co-creator of the podcast American Suburb, and Malika Don, growth editor at Shadow and Act, and managing editor at Really Dope. Thanks, everyone, for being with us. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.